Stay tuned for The Turning Point with Mike Fader. Remind me that, or write into me, I should say, who haven't been listening to the last few shows, wondering why the quality is not as good, the sound quality is not as good. And I just want to remind people once again that I am broadcasting because PRN is looking for some brand new improved studios. Right now, we don't have a regular studio microphone that we're using. So I'm broadcasting from Skype from my own personal home. My large, 14-room, three-story co-op on Park Avenue. Ha, ha. And anyhow, so that's the reason. Maybe one thing I should mention is, before I start in on this, is that it was actually about 10 days ago. I think it was roughly about 10 days ago or more, Holocaust Remembrance Day. And also a couple of days ago, it was a Remembrance Day, which happens every year for the victims of the Armenian Genocide, which is what? It is the anniversary right around this time when the Ottoman Empire, which was shrinking rapidly, basically we're talking about the Turkish Empire, the Ottoman Empire, the Turks murdered. This was a planned murder, very much not exactly like the Germans or the Nazis, because who's as good at that as the Germans when they really wanted to do it, right? Nobody was as good at them, good as them, and the final solutions. But and this was a genocide. This was an attempt to kill as many Armenians as possible, men, women, and children. And they succeeded in killing 1.2 in the years 1915 and 1916. They planned and carried out the plain murder, mass murder, of 1.2 million men, women, and children. And if you ever read the details of it, you don't want to read the details of it. It's just unbelievable, really horrible. It doesn't have, as I say, that mechanized, technical, bureaucratic perfection that the Nazis had in the Holocaust, but it was really one of the most horrible deeds than anybody had ever witnessed yet. Perhaps, actually, nobody had ever seen anything like that in the history of the world, certainly not in a time when communication was possible and people understood exactly what was going on. I remember when I was growing up, I should say when I was chronologically supposed to be growing up, that my grandmother, who, you know, was a young woman at the time of this genocide, this lasted for generations. And even my grandmother would say sometimes when I was way into the 50s, when I was a kid and I was complaining about something, she would talk about, she said, you know, you should eat your food, you know, don't ever forget about the starving Armenians, which meant nothing to me. By the time I was a kid, I was 10, 15 years old, it was, you know, the 50s and the 1960s. It was the Chinese who were constantly having these massive famines, whether or not they're on purpose, you know. But still, that made such an impression on the world. And obviously there were times in the world when there were massive killings of particular ethnic, racial, or religious groups or tribal groups, like, you know, things are going on right now. But this was the one during the first one, and maybe one of the worst ones in the 20th century, in the beginning of the 20th century, that was planned out, and that was carried out as per plan at the highest levels by the Ottoman Empire, the Turks. And it was also, as I say, during a time of communications when people were aware of these things because of you know, cable under the ocean, telegraph, because of, you know, news was able to be spread much more quickly and much more widely. And people in this country collected food in churches and synagogues and private charities to send over to the Armenians who were being brutalized by the Turks. So this is the 100th anniversary of it. And as I say, this is the last week, about 10 days ago, or roughly, was Holocaust Remembrance Day, which is, you know, pretty self-evident what that is. Now, I hear what you're saying, even though I can't hear what you're saying, I hear what you're saying, or what you're thinking, a lot of you. Enough already with this. How long do we have to keep hearing about these things? They're 70, 80, 90, 100 years old. Soon, what happened in the Holocaust will be 100 years old, and everybody, or maybe only a handful of people, will be left alive that suffered personally from it. Why do people keep harping on this? Well, let me get to that later on. Now, coincidentally with this, with these commemorative days, with these remembrances, there is the following. This is an article that appeared in the New York Times last week, and I'll try to read as much of it as my throat will allow me to. What about a throat? You're going to allow me to read this? All right, it says here, former SS member on trial in Germany says he was morally complicit at Auschwitz. You understand that every time they arrest a high, middle, or low-level Nazi or German member of the SS or a prison camp guard, they categorically deny ever having even been the person that was arrested. It's not them. They got the wrong person. They didn't do it. They weren't there. They didn't do it. And if they were there, they didn't do anything wrong. They had a job cleaning up the dishes in the camp, kitchen. This is one of this is unusual already because this guy said he was morally complicit. And we'll get to that in a minute. All right. This is by Allison Smail, who is the reporter, and is from April 21st of last week. Nuremberg, Germany. 7 decades after the liberation of Auschwitz, a 93-year-old former SS member at the Nazi death camp was shuffled, you understand, he's 93 years old, shuffled into a German court on Tuesday to answer charges of complicity in the murders of 300,000, mostly Hungarian Jews. In 2 months, 300,000, mostly Hungarian Jews, in 2 months during the summer of 1944. With Holocaust survivors looking on, the former SS soldier, Oskar Gröning, certainly one of the last Nazis called to account, read to be called to account, probably. How many more of these guys are left that they're going to find and try? Read a chilling but clear account of his life. It focused on the autumn of 1942 to the autumn of 1944, when he served in the SS at Auschwitz-Birkenau. The tardiness of the case against Mr. Gröning, a widower who lives in this small town in northern Germany, did nothing to reduce the tension in the makeshift courtroom, normally an assembly hall. He and his accusers can expect to spend much of the next 3 months here measuring the march of 20th century history through the lives of Nazis and their victims. Unlike those tried decades ago, Mr. Gröning does not deny that he was at Auschwitz and that he saw terrible things. The case turns on whether he is not only morally, but also criminally responsible for what happened there. And this is an important distinction that I hope to get to later. After the state prosecutor, Jens Lehmann, read the charges, Mr. Gröning spoke for an hour, then turned to Judge Franz Kompisch and said, "It is beyond question that I am morally complicit. This moral guilt I acknowledge here before the victims with regret and humility." He asked for forgiveness. You understand, this is also very unusual, to put it mildly. But then he said, "As concerns guilt before the law," he told the judge, "you must decide." So in other words, he's saying he was morally complicit, but it's up to the court to decide if he was legally, if he broke any laws. Whose laws he's talking about, I don't know. Presumably the laws right now in Germany referring to deeds that were committed then, and whether or not he actually did commit any of these deeds or was just a witness to them and shouldn't be punished the same way. But he's making a distinction between being morally complicit and being legally complicit. And where do laws come from, if not from morals? I mean, you know, laws can come from all sorts of places, but where do they come from if they don't come from morality in the first place? I mean, think of the Ten Commandments. Think of the Ten Commandments just as a symbol of that. In this case, dictated by the Lord to Moses. But essentially, the Ten Commandments, like many other basic laws of most countries in the world, and a lot of them based on religion, but a lot of them just sort of growing up out of natural human relationships and civilizations or formations of tribal or, you know, or town or country or county or, again, national or even international relationships. These things are based on the generally accepted morality of the time. So, you know, what was moral once, and these things change over time, variants according to time and place about morality and what becomes law, the law being based on the morals of what is almost the entire community seem to accept or agree is right and wrong. You know, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, et cetera, as far as, you know, not taking the Lord's name in vain or, you know, I am the Lord thy God, thou shalt have no other, that kind of thing. But thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, that kind of thing. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you, a basic concept that is not new in the world. This is not new in the world. So laws are based on morality. But this man, I guess he's making a distinction because, if he says he was morally complicit in these crimes, and I'll read you more of this article here, To me, that means he was legally complicit, especially in his case, where he was an SS guard. And this has to do with individual guilt and collective guilt. A lot of individuals have, other individuals have been tried and convicted, prison camp guards like himself, concentration camp guards have been convicted individually because they share in the collective guilt of what was going on at the time. Not that you could pick a German from 1944 or 1938 off the streets of Berlin and say, you're guilty, right? Although there's a lot of people who are so bitter and so vengeful that they feel that way about Germans entirely. And this is another generation. I don't think a lot of people do now. But this is for the people who were survivors, who were older, who lived during that time, men who fought in this country and other countries against the Germans, the Russians, and everybody in the British, the French, during World War II, and have to put up with the insanity and brutality and the murder of the German nation. But when you have a man who's part of a group of people who are guards at a camp, and you would have to have, I mean, I don't know how intelligent Mr. Gröning here is, but you would have to have the IQ of a frog not to understand, you have to be deaf, dumb, and blind, not to understand exactly how criminal this behavior was. And I make the leap from moral, immoral to illegal. I use them in the same way. In his case, in the case of his particular group, that's what was going on with this article. Mr. Gröning's words riveted dozens of journalists, spectators, relatives of victims, and some of the 65 plaintiffs who have joined state prosecutors in this case. After a break for lunch, the judge spent an hour questioning Mr. Gröning, who took his listeners back through decades to the rise and fall of Adolf Hitler. Mr. Gröning said he had been a bank accountant who was conscripted in the fall of 1940, drafted like many other people in Germany, many other men in Germany were, obviously, and then in other countries later on, and volunteered. He volunteered for the SS because it seemed, quote, always to be out in front, end quote, and came back, quote, covered in glory, end quote, from the swift Nazi successes in Poland and France, sealing Hitler's grip on Europe. So obviously he was young and maybe more than a little ignorant, if this is all true. I mean, what did he think that the German nation and Hitler were doing in Poland and France? Did he think that they were, did he buy all that idiotic propaganda, that was spread by was it Goebbels and everybody else, that the Polish people have violated the rights of Germans and the French, that's actually kind of the French complicated because of World War I and the vindictive nature of the peace pact at Versailles. Anyhow, the defendant, who was lucid almost throughout, said his first doubts about Hitler, he had doubts about Hitler, arose with the invasion of the Soviet Union in the summer of 1941, which Mr. Gröning said he considered unwise given Hitler's tenacity and might. So he considered, he was upset about, he had doubts about Hitler in 1941, not because of anything else that Hitler might have been doing. And, you talk to a lot of Germans from that time, and during that time when people interviewed Germans afterwards, none of them knew what was going on. They didn't know it was a concentration camp, that there were concentration camps. They didn't know the Jews were all being rounded up. They didn't know that the apartment that they moved into had belonged to a Jewish family before. They didn't know that there were the Nuremberg laws against the Jews, and they didn't know that a million other horrible things were going on. They never knew about it. It wasn't their problem. Then it wasn't their fault. Anyhow, he considers it unwise that Hitler did that. It would have been wise to invade Russia and decimate it if Russia wasn't strong, but apparently they were too strong. So he wasn't basing that on anything moral. It was just a bad move. Now listen to this. Mr. Gröning said he was responsible for collecting cash belonging to arriving prisoners at Auschwitz, as state prosecutors have charged, but that he also witnessed atrocities. Just one thing he's admitting to here, just one thing that they're mentioning in the article, is that this man collected cash from prisoners. Who did he think these prisoners were? Who did he think these prisoners were? Did he think that all these women and children and men, all of them in a ragged, starving state, none of them looking like criminals at all, looking like victims of criminals, and they were victims of criminals, he being one of the criminals, he collected their cash. So theft from starving people about to be murdered, including children. I guess that makes him a little morally complicit, but what did he think that was, if not accessory to horrible crimes, collecting, he was stealing from people who were dying already or about to die. Anyhow, he suggested that his doubts grew almost immediately upon his arrival at Auschwitz when drunken guards talked of getting rid of prisoners. And what did he think that was? The atrocities he witnessed, he said, included one night in December 1942 when he was roused from bed to help hunt down fleeing prisoners. In the process, he told the court, he saw prisoners herded into a farmhouse and an SS superior tipped gas out of a can into an opening of the farmhouse. The screams of the prisoners inside grew louder and more desperate, and after a short time became quieter and then stopped completely, Mr. Groening said. That was the only time I saw a complete gassing, he said, emphasizing, I did not take part, he says. The defendant states, reading his account with occasional guidance from his two lawyers, Mr. Groening recalled minute details of his life in the SS, down to the imposing marble and wood carving in the hall where he and his comrades learned of their assignment to Auschwitz. It was presented, he said, as a duty that will demand more from you than at the front, and that had to be kept secret, even from his family. But that was vital to achieving the final solution of eliminating Jews. So I guess that's morally complicit, but it's not legally complicit. The final solution of eliminating an entire people, an entire race or religion or group of people is immoral, but he's claiming to the court that it may not actually be illegal. So these distinctions, I mean, a guy like this making a distinction, a guy like this in this case, who can make a distinction and try to get off. I mean, the man doesn't want to go to jail. He's 93, whatever days, months, or years he has left. He doesn't want to spend it in jail. I understand that. So he's got lawyers, and they're going to try to keep him out of jail. You think a 93-year-old guy should go to jail? One of the defendants in the case, a woman who had actually been in Auschwitz, one of the plaintiffs in the case, a woman who had been in Auschwitz, who is in her 90s, said that she thinks what he ought to do is be made to go out to schools for the rest of his life and talk to junior high school and high school kids about how evil it all was and what he witnessed and what can happen when people get carried away by their worst instincts, which is a suggestion. Other people say, well, I put him in jail, you know, put him to work doing the right thing. But maybe he doesn't really feel any forgiveness. If I had to bet, I'd say he probably doesn't, but he's saying the right things. But who knows? I don't know what's in his soul. This next one here, in November 1942, he recalled, a crying baby was found amid trash discarded by arriving prisoners. The baby's mother had evidently abandoned it in hopes that she would then be chosen for a work crew and not sent to the gas chamber. If she was with the baby, they would have put her straight into the gas chamber. So she made a choice, remember Sophie's choice, she made a choice to save her life at the expense of her baby. If she was single, she might have been sent to a work crew. Nobody knows what happened to her. A fellow SS member, angered by the cries of the baby, beat the infant to death, Mr. Groening said, adding that he complained to his superior, but that no action was taken. Imagine that. I wonder if he filled out a form in triplicate or, you know, he just went and said, you know, that wasn't really a wise thing to do. Am I being bitter about this? It's hard not to, right? Mr. Groening's case not only revives searing questions about the individual guilt for Nazi crimes, but also highlights the decades of legal inaction over Auschwitz, where an estimated 1.1 million people were killed methodically by plan. And it was all planned at the highest levels and carried out. Men, women, and children. Innocent people, civilians. and most of them killed because merely because they were Jewish. About 6,500 members of the SS worked at the camp. Only 49 have been convicted of war crimes. In 1945, Lundberg, that's where this is taking place, I think. Let me get some water here. In 1945, Lundberg, then in the British Allied sector of Germany, was the site of one of the first trials of former guards at the Bergen-Belsen and Auschwitz-Birkenau camps. 11 of those on trial were executed in December of that year. These were guards at the camps. They executed them. I doubt if that's what the what would happen to him if he was convicted. He'd probably just be put in prison. But retribution, shortly after the war, swiftly gave way to the need to rebuild Germany. The crimes committed at Auschwitz, this is politics, rebuild Germany because Americans are big-hearted and Germany was a disaster area, and part of it was a reason it was a disaster area was because the Americans had, for one thing, bombed civilians and killed hundreds and hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians, once again, including children. I always feel like I have to add that. Helpless, innocent people in places like Dresden and Hamburg. And also because they wanted to rebuild Germany. Why? Because it was the, you know, it was the block. It was the wall against the expansion of the Soviet Union. So they stopped trying all these people. And the crimes committed at Auschwitz were at the heart of four big trials in Frankfurt in the 1960s. But for decades after that, little happened as German prosecutors insisted, and this is during the Cold War, that evidence had to tie those accused of war crimes directly to atrocities. You can imagine how difficult it would be to find evidence of something like this. Mr. Groening's prosecution became possible only through the trial of John Demjanjuk, a Ukrainian who immigrated to the United States after World War II. He was eventually sentenced in 2011 in Munich to 5 years in prison for his involvement in the killing of 28,000 Jews at the Sobibor camp in Nazi-occupied Poland. He died in 2012 before his appeal could be heard. For decades before that ruling, prosecutors in Germany had declined to charge anyone with complicity in the Holocaust. And, you know, the sheer numbers involved here almost make it so that that's why you need individual testimony from people who saw and heard things, who witnessed these things on the spot at the time. Because when you talk about 1.1 million people, or like in Rwanda, you know, 1.2 million people, or in Serbia or Bosnia, you know, 86,000 people, and on and on and on. You say 1.2 million Armenians. The sheer size of the numbers diminishes in some bizarre way. It diminishes, it dilutes the individual guilt, which is why charging individual people, if they can catch them, with these things and have the testimony of individuals who witness these things is so important. It makes it more personal, makes it more human. For instance, here's a plaintiff. One of them is named Eva Fahidi, 90, of Budapest, who lost 49 relatives in the Holocaust, including her mother and sister, who were sent to the gas chambers upon arrival at Auschwitz. She was not satisfied with Mr. Groening's testimony and request for forgiveness. After 70 years, he still behaves this way and is still not capable of saying, "I am a sinner," Ms. Fahidi said. Well, he said he was morally complicit, didn't he? And it's all his tone of voice, too. I mean, we are not there to hear the man's tone of voice, and neither was this reporter, I'm assuming. And you can tell everything by the way the man looked and his tone of voice. Another survivor, Ava Kaur, 81, of Terre Haute, Indiana, was also adamant about the fact that feeling guilty doesn't accomplish anything. Well, Ms. Fahidi said she longed for a formal judgment on Mr. Groening. Ms. Kaur argued that he should go out to schools and show how much Nazism destroyed everybody's lives. Marcus Goldbach, Mr. Kaur's lawyer, said he thought that the accused had gone further than ever before, than anybody before, I guess, with his plea for forgiveness. It is a surprise, he said, surprise to him, but I guess it's a surprise, and it is a surprise that any one of these sons of bitches admitted anything that they did was wrong or that they even saw anything wrong. It is a surprise, he said, and may throw a fresh light on Mr. Gronig's claim that he made three requests to be transferred out of Auschwitz. He claimed, although there is no evidence, that he asked for a transfer out of Auschwitz. Presumably, if he was being transferred out of Auschwitz, he would have gone straight to fighting the Russians on the Eastern Front, probably. And nobody wanted to do that. So if he actually did ask for a transfer, it really would possibly mean something. But of course, no one's going to be ever able to prove that, which may be one of the reasons why he said he did it. But who knows? These perspectives will most likely be debated throughout the trial, which coincides with modern atrocities in the Middle East and the commemoration of the Armenian Genocide 100 years ago. And this thing about the Armenian Genocide, again, it happened 100 years ago. And there is nobody alive who can testify to how horrible it was or talk about what they saw and how their family was destroyed. People thrown off cliffs into chasms, including children picked up by one leg and smashed against doors, and people herded into churches and burned the churches down to the ground. That's what the Turks did. You know, Armenians were Christians, Turks were Muslims. There's nobody around to testify on this. But if you listen to some people, if you read diaries or articles that are left, or you listen to very old people report what their grandparents or what their parents told them happened, then it becomes more personal. And then you see the horror and the profound sadness of it. And it becomes more real. More in a little bit. We're going to go to some music. man, Mr. Groening, this 93-year-old man, is the reason he said that he was caught was because he was, I think he was at a chess club with his son, and some other man there, some older man, a German, denied that the Holocaust ever happened. And he got very angry, he says, and told the man it certainly did happen, and he knows because he was there. And maybe this is something on his mind, and finally this is, he couldn't contain it anymore, and he had to get it off his chest. I guess this is all speculation, unless you're there listening to this entire trial. But then, of course, he was identified, one thing led to another, and he was arrested. So this issue of him claiming, once again, that he was morally complicit, that he witnessed horrible inhuman behavior, or is it inhuman? I mean, basically, it's human beings who keep doing these things and have done them for thousands of years and are continuing to do them as we speak right now in various parts of the world, mostly in the Middle East or in Afghanistan. but are, you know, and or in Africa, they're happening right now. But in other times, they've been places, they've happened in Europe, they've happened in the United States. I mean, think about, you know, lynchings in the United States. Think about slavery in the United States. That immorality was the same as illegality. And this changes, as I mentioned before, with time and place. For instance, think of the United States. 150 years ago, before the Civil War. Is that 150 years ago? I think it is. One thing we have at the studio is a cough button, so you don't have to be subject to my constant throat clearings and coughing. Just hit the button and you don't hear it. It's like magic. But we don't have that in our home studio here. Do we? There's nobody else here, actually. I'm pretending there's an audience. But you're the audience, right? You're listening to me right now, either live or you're going to listen to this later on a podcast. Every time I think of podcast, I think of pods from what is that movie, that famous movie where at the end they say, watch the skies, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And these aliens grew up in pods. The aliens landed in pods and became replacements for other human beings in a small town, which I think is happening to a lot of people anyhow in this day and age. It seems that way to me. So meanwhile, this guy, think of this country, think of what was moral and immoral at a certain time and place. Or down south in the United States, before the Civil War, and probably after the Civil War, even though the South lost the Civil War, slavery was considered obviously legal. In fact, it was legal in most parts of the country. If a slave ran away, there was some cases in New York City. I remember reading an old law books, very old law books, when I was in a law library, supposed to be doing research for current cases when I was a paralegal. And I was fascinated to read these old cases where, and some of these are famous cases, where slaves were, if they could be identified and proven to be the property of some slave catchers from down south in various cities up north, they had to be returned by the authorities up north to their rightful owners, right? And if you talk to Southerners down south, probably 999 out of 1,000, or maybe, you know, 999,000 out of a, you know, of a million would tell you, there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. They used to make moral arguments about how slavery was okay. It was, first of all, it's mentioned in the Bible, which people bring up all the time. And secondly, there was, you know, they made the most intelligent people, or at least educated people, and the vast majority of people made arguments that these people are an inferior race. They're hardly even humans. This was the morality of the time, and so it was the legality. Now, little by little, over time, starting, you know, in England, somewhat before the United States, but later on, up north in the northern states, And some people say that's because they didn't rely on them economically. And this is what people would take a Marxian view of everything. And who knows? But still, the abolitionists were from the West and Northwest and the North, not from down South. It was very rare that some of them would be from down South. And they considered it to be the most immoral thing happening on Earth at the time they were alive. Nothing could be more immoral than keeping other people, men, women, and children, splitting up families, selling human beings. Nothing could be more immoral than human slavery. And then later on, war was fought, obviously. And it was fought partially, or some people say primarily, on the basis of this morality. And later on, it became illegal. And then laws were passed. It's constitutional law was passed. Laws were passed in various states. I'm sure there are people right now down South in some southern states who would be very happy to have slavery. And think of many other things according to time and place. In this country, it was once women were totally subservient to men in every way. They couldn't own property. They could be almost at will, beaten up physically, and nothing could be done about it because they were practically the property of men, just as close to slavery as possible. They could not vote ever anywhere, and the women's struggle to vote was extraordinary. Think about unions were illegal in almost every place. People were beaten to death for even meeting to form a union, and on and on and on. And then it was once considered immoral, it is still by a lot of people, but it was once considered so immoral that it became a national law. It became illegal to brew alcohol and to sell alcohol, to brew, you know, to distill alcohol, whatever it's called, and to sell alcohol. So we had prohibition. And then it became, you know, and then for a long, long time, being a homosexual and practicing it in public, or asserting the legitimacy of homosexuality, was completely illegal, and not so long ago, right? And now we have gay marriages, gays in the military, and this is sweeping the country. And what's, I think of a more recent one, marijuana, always a terrible, drug. You know, always illegal and still illegal in many places. But now in some places, perfectly legal, and there are dispensaries and there are stores, medical and non-medical, for marijuana. Things change. And yet, only if talking about time and place, only a few, there are places in Muslim countries right now, in Pakistan, and I think in Myanmar, and probably certainly in Iran, there are places where there are blasphemy laws. We haven't had blasphemy laws in most European countries or in this country for, and I'm not saying one country is better than another country. I'm not saying it out loud anymore. And the United States has nothing to brag about in the world. You know, there was a time when it was considered not immoral, particularly, to evict the Indians from the land that they lived on, throw them out, and practically murder them all. There was talk about a Holocaust, and I use that word, although some people object to, you could call it genocide if you want. Millions of American Indians were killed, starved to death, just plain murdered, and infected with diseases on purpose by the European Americans to take their land, and they considered it not to be immoral because they were just savages. So things change over time, but the remnants of these things are still here. They may be illegal to do all these things now, but look at all the feeling and all the laws that are still attempted to be passed about voting rights, which are racist, which are about abortion rights, which are anti-female. These things still linger over time. It takes a long, long time in human history, according to time and place, for things to finally be considered immoral, even though they are illegal, to things to be considered immoral. That is to say that the majority of people grow up believing that it's wrong. It's just wrong to do this. Not everybody feels this way. Just look at the Republican Party. Just look at the racism all throughout the country and the sexism. It's just extraordinary. So And meanwhile, all this stuff is considered generally immoral and almost entirely illegal in the United States now. And but then you have places like only a few years ago in Saudi Arabia, in Mecca, there was a fire in a girls' religious school. And in a girl, they're all the schools are religious schools, but there was a fire in a girls' secondary school. Was it a junior high or a high school? I don't know. And it was a bad fire. And 15 girls in this school, schoolgirls, burned to death in this school. And why did they burn to death? Because when they attempted to escape and they were able to get onto the school grounds from the burning school and then try to get through the gates to freedom to get out, get away from the burning building, which the Saudi religious police pushed them back into the building. Why? Because they were dressed immodestly. They were not dressed in proper Islamic attire for young women, or for women at all. I mean, imagine that. And there are blasphemy laws in the world. People are arrested. People are set upon and arrested by religious police and by police. Imagine who's a member of the religious police. It reminds you of Nazis in a way. The kind of, a guy like a prison camp guard couldn't have been, bought all this Nazi propaganda, deliberately deluded himself because he wanted to do whatever it is he wanted to do. A lot of these people were just stupid sadists. They were stupid sadists. And I think a lot of the people who would become a religious policeman in Saudi Arabia, can you imagine the kind of chicken brain, sadistic idiot that becomes a religious policeman in Saudi Arabia? Just extraordinary. But these girls were allowed, in fact, caused to burn to death, and nothing ever happened, as far as I know, to these police. And in Saudi Arabia in general, worse than most other places, in Saudi Arabia in general, women, I was going to say can't vote, but nobody's allowed to vote in Saudi Arabia. Women aren't allowed to drive cars. Women in some places, Iran and in Saudi Arabia particularly, aren't allowed to drive cars. They aren't allowed to have the same rights that men are allowed to have. It's considered the norm that women have to be indoors or accompanied by somebody. They can't drive a car. They can't do this. They can't do that. They live stifling lives in a lot of these backward fundamentalist Muslim countries, and some places in our own country too. Some places in our own country too, where women involved in some religious cults and who are involved in very fundamentalist communities are treated in a way which makes them second-class citizens. But over there, the reason for it is the same. It's a continuum, and it's always the same thing. It's because these societies are dominated by men. The religious leaders are fundamentalist male religious leaders who have some terrible fear or hatred of women. Who knows why, but they do, and it's part of their traditions. The worst men in these countries who become the leaders are the ones who dictate what's normal or what's moral. So it's considered... That was considered a moral act. That was a moral act, and thus a legal act by those Saudi religious police. This is at the same time when we're arguing over whether somebody should have an ID card in this country and how immoral it is for states to pass laws about abortion. Sometimes, according to time and place, things vary. The United States has its own crimes to answer for, and they're not always that long ago. I mean, now we're using the president just apologized for using drones. I don't think anybody's ever seen anything like that before. So, these drones frequently kill civilians. But he's talking about practical considerations. He's saying he doesn't want to send an army yet again into yet another country or into these same countries or maintain large military presence because everybody objects to it so much because, as far as I'm concerned, it's immoral. So the drones are the best way to do it, the best way to kill off people who want to, commit terrorist acts in the United States. But he apologized for this. All these things have what Martin Luther King referred to, and I think he was quoting somebody else too, that the moral arc of the universe. It tends to finally bend towards justice, which is when you enlarge that, it's a way of saying that sooner or later, in a lot of societies, in a lot of places, in most societies and places, things are considered perfectly okay. Sacking and looting and burning to the ground whole villages and towns and cities, going into places because somebody else was of a different religion, and just murdering absolutely everybody. Most of the people in the world consider this now to be wrong, although clearly there are groups in the Middle East that don't consider it to be wrong. So it changes according to time and place. But over time, just look at our own country. Now, look at Vietnam. Look at Vietnam. I saw an article the other day that said that people are starting to use the same justification for looking back at, or when they will look back at, our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the same sort of justification, one of the justifications that we use in Vietnam. You know, we had to get in there, and we had to fight the people who were against our way of life, blah, 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 blah. But of course, Vietnam was extraordinarily immoral. It was profoundly immoral, and thus it was illegal. It was an illegal war, an immoral war. What was the United States doing in Vietnam? How do we get to declare war on a country? Well, it wasn't actually called a war. Semantics were used. The bending of legal principles were used. Now, I guess I'm getting down to the point where the question I asked in the beginning of the program was, 100 years since this Armenian genocide, 100 years since this Armenian genocide, and now, you know, what, 70, 80 years since the Jews were rounded up and sent to concentration camps in 60, 70, 80 years in Germany, the Nuremberg laws, where Jews were evicted from their apartments and then rounded up and put into ghettos and then starved to death and ultimately sent to death camps. And 6 million of them were killed in Germany. But soon, not too long from now, it'll be 100 years. And it's 100 years since the Armenian genocide. There's no one left alive. So why keep remembering? There are some people who say that Israel uses the Holocaust, that Israel uses the Holocaust to justify some of its brutality against the Palestinians and its aggressive attitude towards Iran. Maybe they do. Very likely they do. It's a way of using guilt and to get what you want. But, you know, there is plenty of anti-Semitism. And to Jews, even who didn't live through the war, you know, who were born at the end of the war or after World War II, who didn't lose their family but only very distantly lost relatives, so it wasn't personal for them. You can just look around and see right now that there's increasing anti-Semitism all over the world. And it's not just the Israelis, but they're referred to as Jews. There are leaders of Saudi Arabia and Iran that want to wipe them off the map. They would gladly kill every Jew in Israel if they could, and every Jew on earth if they could. So there's something there that has to be watched out for. But you need these apologies. You need these monuments, even though it was a long time ago. And some people say, enough already. I don't want to hear about it anymore, right? Why not forgive and forget? Forgiveness and forgetting is considered to be one of the most healing things there is. I mean, personally speaking, anybody who's had experience with this, and I've struggled with this myself, is if you can forgive, then finally you can move on and forget. Societies, whole societies have tried to forgive other groups in their societies and other ethnic and religious groups for what they did. Without forgiving, how could you ever get through things? But you need these apologies. Even for forgiving, you need the Turkish government to apologize. You need memorials. You need to maintain the ruins of Auschwitz. These things have to be maintained because as a collective people, as human beings, we have to have this in our memory bank, or we will never, never, never have a chance to finally rise above it to the point where we would never even imagine this or plan it or carry out anything like this again. All right, I'll see you next week.
Thank you.